I want to start for our message today with a memorable story from my life that some of you may have heard me tell before. I was dropping off my son at a neighbor's home daycare. This was a Wednesday back in 2016. But this particular Wednesday back in 2016 was the day after Trump won in 2016, November, the election. And I remember being in disbelief. I remember feeling some fear, feeling some shame, because many who were more worried about the possibility of that, I was one of the people who was saying, don't worry, it can't happen, it can't happen. So I was feeling a lot of things that morning. And so I go and I drop off my son at our neighbor's, her name is Mona, and we exchange our usual how are yous. And I sighed deeply and said, today is heavy. And I think like my eyes just kind of bugged out a little bit as I said it. Mona and her family are Muslim, and I knew without asking, they were hurt by Trump's rhetoric. And so she sighed as well, and she said goodbye. And I went about my day and tried to do my work day. When I picked up my son at the end of the work day from Mona, Kezia, my wife, was already there. And I walk in, and Kezia and Mona are like, crying and hugging each other and like sitting and having this like beautiful emotional moment. And I was like, hello. And she turns and says to me, Mona turns and says to me, she said, I'm so glad you said what you said this morning because I just didn't know. I just didn't know. She kept on saying, I just didn't know. And I thought about that so much. I could know without asking how Mona felt about the possibility of a Trump presidency. But she couldn't know about me. The family of the boy that she watched, whose dad is a white pastor of a church, when the vast majority of white Christian males voted for Trump in 2016, right? I could know without asking, but not her. She couldn't know. We had all of the cards in that situation because of our religious background and race, and it was such a relief to Mona to find out that she didn't have to tiptoe around us or pretend. So this is a window for me, this experience, into the experience of Christian supremacy for someone who is not a Christian. And it also solidified in me negative feelings myself toward Christian supremacy as a Christian, because it was incredibly uncomfortable for this person who I have generally good connection with to like be in a situation where they're not sure how to see me. Like, it sucks to be viewed as a supremacist or as a possibly a supremacist, right? But is that just part of the fine print for being a committed person of faith, particularly a committed Christian? Hopefully by the end of this morning, you don't think so. So we are continuing our theme for Lent, these 40 days that lead up to Good Friday and Easter Sunday. Easter's coming fast, y'all. It's the last day of March this year. And what we do is we jump off the tradition of giving up things for Lent, right? You've heard that before, like chocolate or screen time. If you've spent much time in churches, maybe you were encouraged to give up something every Lent. Our tradition here at Brownline is to give up unhelpful and incomplete beliefs for Lent, but not going back to them like we might go back to chocolate. Instead, our goal is during these messages to also construct some alternative beliefs in the place of those ones that we are giving up. And today, the question that we're exploring is, can Christianity be a distinct, vital contribution to the world of ultimate importance, worth giving your life to, worth giving your death to in some cases, and other world religious expressions and traditions also have truthful, distinct, ultimate things to offer the world too? Are those mutually exclusive? This is what we're going to explore today. Does Christianity have to be the only true religion for it to be worthwhile? It's an interesting question. Have you ever phrased it that way to yourself? Maybe not. So that's what we're going to explore today. This is what popular discussion of religion assumes today, that religion is what's called a zero-sum game. Only one can win, okay? It's either Christian salvation or Buddhist enlightenment. You either support Hindu India or Muslim Bangladesh. either Allah of the Quran, Yahweh of the Hebrew Bible. And oh, the violence that this all stokes, right? We have Netanyahu right now, unable to see the voice of the victim in his own scriptures, and instead patting himself on the back for creating thousands more victims. Oh, the violence that this sort of thing stokes. Even inside these traditions, right? Conflict breaks out, either Sunni Muslim or Shiite Muslim, either Catholic or Protestant. And within Protestantism, oh boy, right? We're not sure that that church across the street is Christian. They say they are, but yeah. We don't need to be convinced of like the constant possibility of violence on one hand, microaggressions on the other, right? We don't need to be convinced of that. And if it's a zero-sum game with only one winner, then it's also important to note that power imbalances are a part of all of these struggles too. And that's why today we're not just talking about religious conflict as though everyone is essentially on the same footing. We're talking about Christian supremacy, is this phrase that we're using. Christian supremacy in particular is something that needs to be acknowledged as a global reality, because most of the money and the military might in the world resides with Christians. Christian supremacy overlaps with other supremacies in our world: white supremacy, Euro-American supremacy, male supremacy. We might hear about all of these things. They all overlap with Christian supremacy. I remember attending a lecture by a Korean-American theologian named Grace Jisun Kim. And she pointed out how in her world, in the academy, like, so, you know, smart people talking about smart things, no one bats an eye when scholars use Greek or Latin concepts like spirit to talk about Jesus. Did you know that's a Greek concept, Latin concept, spirit? Yeah. No one bats an eye when we use those concepts to talk about Jesus. But when she, a Korean American, uses concepts from her heritage like chi or han to talk about Jesus, she's accused of pushing too far beyond Christianity, right? Christian supremacy overlaps with other supremacies in our world. And so to combat Christian supremacy, all sorts of supremacies, the unhelpful belief that we're talking about today, people of goodwill all over the world throughout history, especially since World War II, since the Holocaust, since the dropping of the nuclear bomb, there have been searchings, earnest searchings, for ways to maintain a pluralist reality. Do you know this word? Pluralist? Pluralism? Have you heard this before? Yeah? Seeing some nodding heads. Okay, pluralist. The idea of we need to find a way to have a coexistence with our many beliefs, our plurality of beliefs. A pluralist reality. This is good news. We've been thinking about this. Throughout history, people of goodwill have thought about this, especially in the last 70, 80 years. People have been thinking about this. Social media can make it feel like no progress has ever been made in anything, and no progress ever will be made, right? No, no, they're good things have developed. There are ways forward here if we're talking about having a meaningful coexistence of all of our many beliefs. But now, if you grew up steeped in Christian supremacy, chances are pluralism was considered a bad word. The P word, pluralism. Don't use that word around me. If you grew up in Christian supremacy or around those sorts of messages, you probably were told that the idea of pluralism cheapens Jesus' claim in John chapter 14 that he is the way, the truth, and the life. Now, I'm going to be clear this morning that from my perspective, what I'm going to try to draw, help us toward here as a church, is that I don't agree. but neither am I giving up on Jesus's claim to be the way, the truth, and the life. And you might wonder, is that possible? Sounds a little impossible, Vince. Sounds a little paradoxical, Vince. And you know what? If so, awesome. Awesome. I love paradoxes. That's where the good stuff is. So we're going to talk about a paradox today. I am using pluralism as a good and necessary word today, as an antidote to Christian supremacy, and I believe I can still fully say that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life at the same time. How on earth, you might ask? Thank you. How on earth? The how is the difference. Somebody used my ridiculous voice too. Somebody said, how on earth? The how is in the difference between a surface pluralism and a deep pluralism. That's what we're going to work today. The difference between a surface pluralism and a deep pluralism. Let's talk about a surface pluralism first. This is this week's better, but still incomplete belief. It is probably the default position of most of us in a place like Chicago. A surface pluralism says something like, we're all climbing the same mountain, but we are different paths up that mountain. Right? Like there's an ultimate truth we're all climbing to reach, and our paths represent, like the paths on that mountain represent the different religious expressions and traditions through which we all climb as different citizens of the world. That is a huge improvement over Christian supremacy, right? Huge improvement. It seems to evade a lot of the danger that we just talked about. So this is not bad, even though I'm going to call it incomplete in a second. It's a totally normal way that we reflect our wider culture's progress in moving past supremacist understandings of religion or any matter, like we're talking about white supremacy or male supremacy. This is a totally normal way that we reflect we've made progress. I think of coexist bumper stickers that I saw everywhere growing up in Chicago and Evanston. Anybody ever seen the coexist and they've got like all the different like religious icons? Perfect examples, great. But like many autopilot positions in any culture, if you dig a little deeper, there can be some problems, okay? Because while this is generous in a way it says like Christian salvation, Buddhist enlightenment, potato, potato, right? They're all the same, right? We should be able to coexist. It can also be kind of arrogant in that same way to say, like, we should just be able to coexist. Is it really that easy to just coexist? Yeah? It's easy to say from a Christianized perspective, where you hold most of the cards and the power and the privilege, right? We should just be able to coexist. I don't know, though. I wonder if we ask our non-Christian friends, do they agree that Christian salvation, Buddhist enlightenment, same thing, no big deal, we're all climbing the same mountain. So there's a papering over of distinctiveness here that still privileges Christianity. And a good parallel is race relations in America. So I remember years ago, this was like, what was it? 7 or 8 years ago, I think, a friend here at Brownland Church led a small group that was on racial identity and race relations. And we read a book together, and we all learned how to tell the story of our racial identity. It was really, really good. And this was the first place that I learned there is a name for the Kool-Aid that I drank growing up in racially diverse Evanston, Illinois, where we fashioned ourselves progressive and forward-thinking. Oh, we were just... all of those others who will someday reach our status of enlightenment. But we had just as much racial conflict as any town in America. We would give off the vibe, though, of like, well, but I don't see color. All I see is human beings. You ever heard that vibe before, right? I don't see color, I just see human beings. It is such a classic blunder in race relations that scholars actually have a name for it. And this is where I first learned that. I was like, oh God, there's a name for this? That means it's bad. It's called colorblindness. And it doesn't work to help with race relations because it papers over the distinctiveness of the marginalized experiences rather than seeks to honor those. It's like, oh, we're all the same. You're not really different. No, I am different. My experience is very different from yours, oh, white person, right? So that's a great parallel for this. Haley, our connections pastor, a while back, she made the connection to me for our topic today. Surface pluralism is the religious version of I don't see color. It's I don't see religion. Yeah. Papers over distinctiveness there, right? But there's a second issue with surface pluralism. And that is, by definition, it suggests that anyone who is a part of a religious tradition or expression should stay on the surface of that tradition or expression. This produces a bit of a shallow faith. Now, For those of you who grew up in more Christian supremacist settings, you hear me use a phrase like shallow faith, and you're like, is he about to pull a bait and switch? What are you about to say, Vince? Now, Christian supremacists do like to point out that a shallow faith is a bad thing. But unlike that perspective, my issue with the shallow faith is not that God needs our defending from devotion that's not good enough. My sense is that God is not so defensive, not so needy. But my issue is there with the shallow faith. And let me explain. If you're playing along with Lent bingo, I'm about to do philosophy corner with Vince. So here we go. Some philosophers wonder if, in the long term, there is no such thing as a surface devotion for humans. One way or another, every human being worships something. There's no such thing as surface devotion, okay? Let's roll with that for a second. If people in the West, like us, are keeping religion at arm's length in an effort to avoid Christian supremacy, great, that has some benefits. But maybe we have to be aware that something else is going to take religion's place as our object of devotion. Because it's not an option to not worship. We're going to roll with that idea. It's not an option to not worship. Everybody has an object of devotion. And if that is the case, I'm compelled. Maybe you're not, but roll with it. If that is the case, what is the default object of worship for our secular age? The market. We exchange God for the invisible hand. Did you ever learn about the invisible hand of the market in school? Anyone ever heard that phrase before, the invisible hand? Okay, yeah, a few people have heard this. So this is the idea of like, there's an invisible hand with the market. It will just take care of things. Just leave the market alone. Don't mess with it. Don't regulate it. Don't tinker with it, because it will sort everything out. It'll sort out injustice. It'll sort out inequality. The market will take care of everything. That is worship language, right? Like that's like treating this invisible, it even uses a cult-like phrase, the invisible hand. Yes, you know, the invisible hand will take care of us. Like, we've exchanged God for a picture of the economy that has a God-like figure called the invisible hand, who will supposedly take care of everything. The invisible hand's religious-like grip on us is so insidious that we don't even realize it. We are assured of our salvation by insurance policies and savings accounts. Our sacraments are go to school, get a career, buy lots of stuff, and retire. Our confession booth is social media, where we demonstrate our good deeds of performing ourselves well and producing for the economy. The market can feel like an exhausting religion with a cruel God demanding our worship and our sacrifice. And the ethic of such a God, such a religion, always is going to come back to profit, not love. We can dress up profit however we want, but it is not meant to be an ethical foundation. It is too cold. It is too unfeeling. The invisible hand is a lie. In service of an ethic of love, money can be a great asset. But as an ethic itself, it cannot stand. Global profits of companies, country GDPs are booming more than ever before. But billions of people all over the world, including here in America, still experience economic depression. The New Testament scholar Dom Crossan says, ask not whether the economy booms, ask for whom it booms, right? I am very compelled by the suggestion that some scholars today make that the most adhered to global religion in the world is economism. It's not actually Christianity. It's economism. You know, Jesus did present a binary about worship in his teachings, but it wasn't against other religions of his day. It was against mammon, the old-timey word for riches. You can't serve both God and mammon, Jesus said. And if Jesus is right, this explains another big reason why surface-level pluralism in our context is incomplete, because we are in danger of exchanging Christian supremacy for the supremacy of the market. If we just stay on the surface of a tradition, something else will take the object of our devotion, and chances are it's going to be the market, which has escalated. You know, we talked about violence, we talked about exploitation and privilege and oppression of people. The market is doing far more than anyone right now. So I suggested there is another kind of pluralism, though. That's the beautiful hope that I have to share today, is that there is another kind of pluralism, a deep pluralism. And I want to give us two images to explain a deep pluralism. The first one is from Jesus in Matthew chapter 13 in the Bible. I'm going to put it up on the screen here for us and read for us. Jesus told another parable. The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field. But while everyone was sleeping, his enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat and went away. When the wheat sprouted and formed heads, then the weeds also appeared. The owner's servants came to him and said, "Sir, didn't you sow good seed in your field? Where then did the weeds come from?" "An enemy did this," he replied. This is, by the way, one of the absolute best lines in the whole Bible to take out of context. Try it. Try it with your partner or roommate. "Why are there so many dirty dishes in the sink?" "An enemy did this." Take that one home. Okay. It's ridiculous. So the servants asked him, why are there weeds? "An enemy did this." The servants asked him, "Do you want us to go and pull them up?" "No," he answered, "because while you are pulling the weeds, you may uproot the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. At that time, I will tell the harvesters, 'First collect the weeds, tie them in bundles to be burned, then gather the wheat and bring it into my barn.'" So Jesus' point here is, we humans are not trustworthy to weed the field. That's the point of this parable. We're not trustworthy to be deciding who is in or who is out in some eternal sense. Even though we really want to, right? "Let us pull the weeds up for you, God. We can do it." No, Jesus says, that is a job for a God of perfect love and justice, not fallible, limited humans. What's our job? Till the soil. Deepen the roots of the good seed. Hold that in mind, and I'm going to give you a second image here. This one is from contemporary theologians. Remember the mountain image of surface pluralism? We're all climbing the same mountain, right? It's a little incomplete because it collapses our differences rather than honors them. A deep pluralism says, what if there are many mountains, each with many paths? What if there are multiple ultimate truths that human beings are striving for in our efforts to live meaningful and purposeful and loving and resilient lives? If we can set aside the worst tribal versions of our various world religions, obviously we want to set those aside. What are the best versions of each of our religious expressions and traditions distinctly contribute to our larger human project? Because we're all needed. We need the excellent guides up the different mountains that need to be summited. For us here, a Christian church, the world needs Christians' expertise on climbing the mountain of personal divine love, imaged in Jesus who shows the way, the truth, and the life to that personal divine love. But the world also needs the expertise of the Buddhist on climbing the mountain of non-personal reality, oneness with reality, acceptance, radical acceptance of our circumstances. And then there are other mountains too. And there are multiple paths up our Christian mountain, not just BLCs. What these images recommend is not a pluralism that is built on surface engagement with our religious expressions and traditions, but a pluralism that is built on deep engagement with our religious expressions and traditions. That is paradoxical, but it is true. And we know this again. Think of race relations. Do you remember my story earlier of our small group that I attended and I learned, oh my gosh, like I've been saying, I don't see color. In the same way we can learn, I've been saying I don't see religion, but we're pushed beyond that to say like, well, maybe there's actually something where we need to identify our distinctives. Years later, after that small group, I remember feeling so much freedom in a workshop about anti-racism. And it taught me that to become an anti-racist doesn't mean I have to read every book on the matter and become an eloquent speaker about every racial identity in the entire world. It doesn't mean that I have to do that. That's an overwhelming prospect. It's and kind of arrogant, actually, for a white person to say that I can speak for anybody else's racial identity. So thank God that's not what's before me. That is not the way that we actually become more anti-racist. Actually, the way that we become more anti-racist is first learning to tell the story of our own racial identity. Deepening in engagement and in awareness of where we come from, where we are rooted. Light bulb moment, so helpful. The more I learn how to do that with my own self is the way that I can then be curious about somebody else. It is the same way with religion. The people who know their roots, they're not on the surface, they are deep down in the roots of their religious expression and tradition. The people who know that the most are not the most tribal, they're the most humble. Those are the religious leaders that we long to listen to. The Desmond Tutus of the world, who last summer we talked about his book, The Book of Forgiveness. It is the most chock full of wisdom book that's probably been written in the last 30 years. Because Desmond Tutu knows his roots, and that has made him not Christian supremacist. I can't speak for other traditions, but I can speak for my tradition, the Christianity that Brown Line Church tries to represent. And I love what we distinctly contribute. I am giving my life to it. A personal God who is beyond us and yet within us at the same time. And that God is a God of love. That God is a God who suffers with me in the hardest things in life, like Jesus, rather than is removed from me in some timeless throne room. The idea that self-sacrificial love is what makes the world go round, not winning, triumph, proving yourself. The idea that resurrection comes after death, which is what we're about to celebrate here as we come to the end of Lent and announce it on Easter Sunday. Resurrection comes after death. Death is not the end of any story. I love contributing that to the world. I am giving my life for it. So what sort of things do you see that you like, oh my God, this is so worth getting rooted in? And that doesn't make me more of a bigot, more of a supremacist. It's like if life is many mountains, each with many paths, the only way you can see people on the other mountains is to summit your own, right? If we are all in the same soil, the only way to not be uprooting each other is to deepen our own roots, right? It's paradoxical, but it's true. Deep engagement is what allows us to see the other for who they are and honor and respect them and see them contribute and allow you to contribute what you offer. It's not surface engagement. That's not how we do that. Paradoxical, but it's true. What a beautiful calling that we can lay down some roots. And so I want to give an impassioned plea one last time for our Lent mealtime prayers. This is something that we've been releasing for friends, families, roommates in our church to do at home together. Devotions, liturgies that you can do on your own. If you have not done one yet, fine. That's no problem. Try it today if you want to. They'll go out today after service. We release them on Instagram and email and then in our Discord. We're releasing them every Sunday, and then also you'll get one on Good Friday. And the idea here is to help you direct your devotion intentionally. Because maybe if we don't, the sacraments of the market will be the only thing that we see our footsteps walking toward, right? But if we can direct our devotion, our church wants to help with that. Our church wants to release things that you can pray with honesty with integrity, not looking over your shoulder, not thinking like, oh gosh, I'm so uncomfortable saying this because I don't believe it. No, we want to provide you with things that you can find yourself praying honestly that aren't Christian supremacist, but that are directing your devotion so that the market doesn't just absorb all of our life. And we don't just feel like, I always say, we don't just feel like lines on a transaction sheet, because that's what American life is so often. You're just another line on a transaction sheet for some employer somewhere. But we are not just that. We are human beings made to worship and devote ourselves to things. Man, devoting yourself to a God that looks like Jesus is so, so valuable. So, my impassioned plea for our mealtime prayers, give these a shot. See how they feel praying. They take like 5 minutes. The idea, if you're a parent, we have a four parent sections, because reading through the prayer, the text that's on it on the page itself isn't always going to work for younger kids. So we have some encouragements for you and ways that you can use it for your setting. But I really like where we're going in these mealtime prayers, and I think you will too. I think you will find yourself feeling like it makes sense and it's not creating a Christian supremacy in you. Okay, on that note, I want to pray for us today. And you may laugh at this, but this is the closest our church is ever going to get to an altar call, okay? So you can enjoy that while it lasts, or you can rest assured that that's the case. But essentially what I want to do is, nobody, I'm not going to put anybody on the spot here. We're certainly not going to do anything like that. But I do feel like, if we can say the best version of the evangelical faith of America in the last 50s has encouraged people to make moments of decision, okay? Like, to make a commitment to something. And please throw, like, if there are any triggers in you, just forget what I'm saying. Just tune me out to put your earbuds in or something like that. But if you're not triggered by that, if the idea of making a commitment to the Christian faith in the way that we're talking about today, where you are not a supremacist, but you are committing to something because deep engagement will save you in a way that surface engagement will never do that. If that feels enticing to you or like a worthy calling to you today, I do want to pray specifically for you. I'm not going to call you out. You don't have to like make yourself known. But I just want to pray for you in that space. And then I want to pray for all of us. So if you would take a deep breath with me, take a deep, get comfortable in your seat. Did that crack of my back get picked up on the microphone? Maybe. Okay, I want to start with anyone who, in your own mind, you are feeling like, yeah, I think I want to make a renewed commitment to the Christian faith, which is just sounds hilarious to me to say that out loud up here on the microphone. But I really mean this. If you are feeling like today you are making a renewed commitment to Christian faith, I want to bless that commitment that you are making. God of love, you look down on no one. You refuse the violence that so long humans have projected onto you. Even in the Bible itself, we project violence onto you. We make you sound like an angry, petty God. But you reject all of that. You are a beautiful God of love. The voice of the victim that is throughout the scriptures is the voice of you, God. And that is what we carry on today. And what a beautiful calling it is to contribute to the world from that perspective, to be the voice of the victim, to be the voice of Jesus who stands for those who cannot stand for themselves, who loves those who are outcasts, and who guides us to a life where we are not devoted to mammon, to riches, but we are devoted to love of neighbor and to love of self in a very deep way. If any of us are making a commitment to that right now, we just receive your feedback, God. We're not making that out to an invisible hand that doesn't exist. We are making that to a God who is inside of us by the Spirit and can remind us, can give us a kind of like, oh, yes, I acknowledge your acknowledgement of me. And we can feel that. We can feel that like a load off our shoulders. We can feel that like a warmth in our chest. We can feel that like our hands feel a little bit like wet and moist from sweat because we're just like, this is important. This is holy. This is sacred. This is something. And so whatever it is, like whatever way that we're feeling like, yeah, something is happening here. We commit ourselves to you, God, not to fight the rest of the world, but to contribute to the rest of the world, to bless the rest of the world as Jesus did. And now I want to pray for those of us who are just here. We don't really feel like we're in that place of making a renewed commitment. That's cool. That's cool. Somebody else wants to do that. But we're just here, and this feels big. This is about violence. This is about what's happening in Gaza. This is about what's happening in the election right now here in America. This is about big stuff. And so we pray, God, that if there's a way forward, and it's something like this deep pluralism that we're talking about as a church right now, fan the flame of that, because something has got to rise to awareness that is better than Christian supremacy, and something has got to rise to awareness and prominence that is better than a surface pluralism. The world needs something better than that. It needs something better than that from churches. And so, God, I pray on behalf of this church, we commit ourselves to being a part of the solutions and not the problems. We repent of Christian supremacy, and we commit ourselves to something that is deep engagement with our tradition, not surface engagement with our tradition. In Jesus' name, amen.